Starwalker Studios presents GM Intrusions, the podcast devoted to Numenera and the strange.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 33 of GM Intrusions, the podcast devoted to Numenera and the strange. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. I've got a great show for you today. Brian Kershaw joins me to discuss his experiences as a player and game master of Numenera. So grab your dice and get ready to spend some effort. It's time for a GM Intrusion.
GM Intrusions Roundtable.
Brian Kershaw joins me on the show today. He's a fellow Cypher System GM. So welcome to the podcast, Brian.
Thank you very much, Lex. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you here. And I want to thank you. Brian is the one that finally settled the debate about the Dread Destroyer and sent me that great image with it circled on the size comparison chart. So thanks for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed it now that you showed it to me.
I think it was just because it was hidden down in the corner there. So people were looking around, trying to find it somewhere in the background and just kind of hidden off to the side.
Yeah, totally. So why don't you start out and just tell us a little bit about your history and experience with role-playing games?
Absolutely. I started gaming back in 1991. It was about 8 or 9. And just a little kid exploring the parents' basement, and I found this old, like, steamer trunk and flung that open and managed to actually find the old D&D blue box tucked away inside.
Oh, wow.
It's like you could not find a better way to start off role-playing by discovering an actual treasure chest containing actual treasure.
That's so cool. And you said you were 8 or 9 at the time?
Yep.
Wow, so you got started a lot earlier than I did.
I wound up kind of devouring that and then just needing more stuff. So I jumped into second edition D&D. And then from there, it's been a huge collection of different things. From Shadowrun to Call of Cthulhu to all manner of World of Darkness games. Some indie stuff like the Chaosium Basic role-playing system.
Okay.
To the Dragon Age role-playing game, all kinds of different things over the years.
So of all of those, what's your favorite so far that you've played?
That I've played, I would actually say Changeling the Lost.
Oh, cool.
Which is the new World of Darkness update for Changeling the Dreaming.
Right, right. Did you ever play Changeling the Dreaming?
I had the book, but I'd never been able to actually start a game of it.
Okay. I think, actually, I might have the book for Changeling the Lost around here somewhere, but I never played it or ran it or really dig too deep in it. Mm-hmm. So you really enjoyed playing that game, huh?
Very much so. It had finally gotten to the point with 3rd edition where playing 3.5 for years, I was just really getting burned out on gaming. And okay. I didn't want to GM much anymore. I wanted to really kind of take a break from it. And Changeling the Lost was so cool that it just totally hooked me back in.
Awesome.
It's really like a 180 from where Changeling the Dreaming was, where you had all of these kind of heavy World of Darkness settings, and then you had Changeling the Dreaming, which was kind of friendly and kind of engaging and more high fantasy.
Yeah.
And then Changeling the Lost totally flips that around. And it is just a really potentially very grim kind of game. Pun. It's got a lot of heavy themes. And in the experience that I had with it, it was just something where I couldn't put book down once I started reading it. And I would start telling players about it and they'd be like, oh, man, really? And then they had to start reading it and they wanted to play it. So unlike a lot of the other World of Darkness games where you're kind of like a fixed supernatural thing,
right?
Changeling the Lost really encourages you to come up with anything, and it gives you these really broad guidelines but you were just an ordinary human being who got kidnapped by the Fae. And what that means in your specific context can completely change from the next person's. And in your time that you were gone, you were changed into this other sort of human, but not quite thing. And you come back, you finally get back to the mortal world somehow, only to discover no one has noticed you're gone. Because when you were taken, you were replaced by what's called a fetch, which is sort of this combination amalgam creature that looks like you and sounds like you and is living your life, but is just a little bit off from who you were.
Right. So actually the kind of folklorish changeling that, that has replaced you and is a horrible child to raise.
Yep. And so, I mean, that really kind of, for me, caught the real horror of the World of Darkness game is you've endured these horrible things, you've slogged through this terrible stuff, and you finally get back and find out nobody can relate. Like, you've endured these terrible, awful things, and yet no one even knew you were gone. The Fetch, in some ways, might even be living your life better than you had been.
Okay.
So that really kind of was jarring to the players and was jarring to me as a GM. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of neat. I could do some cool things with that.
Yeah.
So
did you, as a character, when you came back, did you remember your time in the other world, or was it basically like amnesia?
In bits and pieces.
Okay.
And sort of the more powerful your character gets, the more closely they're connected to the Fae that took them.
Okay.
And also the more they remember everything that happened.
Awesome. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool thing to play around with.
Now, is that game still, are they still releasing supplements for that game, or is it retired?
It's mostly retired. That one came out as a limited run.
Okay.
So there's the core book, there's maybe 5 or 6 supplements out there, and then occasionally as Onyx Path, previously White Wolf, releases new material, they include references to changelings, they include new powers and things, and little tie-ins here and there.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm going to have to dig that book out and look into it some more. I remember just being very dismayed by the lack of color. But that was old changeling, which it sounds like is a totally different kind of mood to it than the new changeling. So I guess fits.
The new one has a very kind of green aesthetic to everything that's a little weird. It's not full color anymore.
Okay.
But I think that was just to kind of cut down on printing costs, too.
Sure. Yeah, those original changeling books were beautiful. And even at the end of second edition, they started putting out books that were black and white.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, it's much less common to see full color runs these days, which is part of why I'm so happy with the new Monera book.
Yeah. Yeah, and it looks like from the few teasers we've seen that the Strange book is going to be the same way, full color and lots of art and similar layout and everything. Looking forward to seeing it.
That's actually been one of the best tools I've had for getting people involved in Numenera, is actually showing them the book.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing everybody does when you hand them a book is they kind of flip through it and they see, oh, what does it look like?
Right.
And as soon as people start seeing the images in Numenera, they're like, oh, that's weird. Oh, that's cool. I got to see what's going on there. What's going on in that scene?
Yeah. 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 I'm very much influenced by art and visual stuff. And there have been games, like for instance, Fate, where, you know, I look through the Fate book and the art is just very unimpressive and it just doesn't grab me visually the way Numenera does and the way Changeling did. And even Vampire, they had some great art in Vampire the Masquerade.
Yeah.
So, of the games you've GM'd, which has been your favorite?
That's got to be Numenera.
Okay.
I have not run a game that's been as intuitive and as easy for the game master as Numenera is. Prior to this, I was playing some 4th edition D&D.
Okay.
And that is very much a game where you need miniatures, you need a battle mat,
right.
You need a pre-planned route that everything is going to go.
Yep.
And as somebody who's GM, you know, there is never a pre-planned route that the players will actually follow.
Right.
So I would make up all these like cool encounters, and there would be all kinds of stuff going on. It'd be all action movie set piece, and the players would be like, yeah, we go around it.
Yeah.
Or, oh, that doesn't sound very interesting. We're just not going to go there. And I was like, well, in that case, I'm going to find really good reasons for you to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. When I used to run third edition in 3.5, that was when I first started using miniatures. And I just had this very generic grid that I use. It actually, I think it came in the back of the Game Master Guide for 3.5. And I just used that for everything. But when I got into Pathfinder, they have these, I think they call them flip maps. But they're very detailed, like for specific encounters, and they're like wet erase materials, so you can draw on them with a marker. And so I started like drawing out actual maps of the actual places ahead of time. And then yeah, it kind of it was tempting to railroad the players, because it's like, I spent an hour drawing out this map.
And you're just going to avoid it?
Yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah, for me, it started actually back in second edition when there was a character who ran past somebody and someone said, wait, I get an attack of opportunity. And we had to spend like an hour going through the movement system, looking through the attacks of opportunity rules, talking about, well, was he inside of the range? Was he outside of the range?
Right.
And I was like, fine, we'll just use maps from now on.
Yep.
And after that, it always had to be maps.
So when you run Numenera, do you use maps or miniatures of any kind, or you don't use them at all?
I haven't needed them. It's just so intuitive and easy. Talking about distances, I can just really ballpark things.
Right.
I found that the players are really comfortable with that idea.
Yeah.
And the system itself really makes that easy.
Yeah, I love the whole immediate, short, long range thing. It just...
Yep.
And that's something, like, I always had a problem, even all the way back to second edition D&D, of visualizing distances. And because a lot of times it would matter with your spells and stuff, and the player would want to know if they're within 30 feet or something. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm not even sure what 30 feet looks like, honestly. And so I just always, I was basically ballparking it anyway. I just wasn't letting them know that. But the immediate, short, long, like that, I can visualize and wrap my head around, you know, it's like,
yeah,
well,
definitely
immediate. You can get there like and do an action, you know, it's like practically within reach. And short, it's like, well, you know, it's a few steps away, but not super far. And then long, well, you know, it's going to take you a little bit to get there. It's
exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the other thing is with the system for levels. And really taking dice out of the GM's hands.
Yeah.
As a game master, I've just been able to focus on telling a story. I can just ballpark things right off the top of my head. So if the players go totally off the rails and I'm like, oh, you've found a thing. They're like, well, I want to know about it. I'm like, well, most people would know something about this, but it's going to be a little challenging. Level 4.
Yeah. 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 It's, I was just running, an adventure the other night with a lot of traps, and it's so nice that, you know, the difficulties are all based on the level. So it doesn't matter if, you know, the trap actually goes off and they have to make a speed defense to avoid whatever happens, or if they're trying to find the trap to begin with, or if they're trying to disable it or smash it. It's all, you know, the numbers are all based on that same level, and it makes it really easy, where in other games I've played, all those numbers would be different, and you'd have to have them written down somewhere and look them up.
Very, very true.
So these days, do you tend to play or GM more?
I tend to GM a lot more.
Okay.
I've generally found that people, particularly new players, think GMing is going to be super hard.
Okay.
And so they're really hesitant to try it out, but... That's another thing I'm really enjoying about this system is I've been able to talk a lot more people into trying to sit behind the screen.
Oh, awesome.
Just since, you don't really need to worry about memorizing all the rules.
Right.
Because I mean, you take a look at those giant, like 500-page manuals, no one can remember all that. You can get a sense after a while, but like hefting that Pathfinder book, you're like, oh, I'm going to need to have some handy sticky notes and references all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah, that Pathfinder book's great for home defense, though. Mm. You club someone with that thing, they're going to feel it.
I do definitely believe that.
So do you think Numenera is a good game then for a new GM to try to GM their first time?
Oh, absolutely. I've actually had a couple of friends who have never GM'd before who are willing to try it with Numenera, just because the way the Cypher system is set up with the levels, with kind of the basic creatures, and the ability to really come up with stuff on the fly, they feel like they can play around a little bit more. Like, right. It's a much lower stakes game to get involved with. Yeah. And so that's been really benefiting that.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I personally find that is challenging about the system is the GM intrusions. But I have noticed, I've watched or listened to a lot of actual play sessions on YouTube and on podcasts. And, you know, I've been in some games myself and run some games myself. And I've seen more than once where maybe the first session or two, the GM doesn't do many or any GM intrusions. And even when even if there's no GM intrusions the whole session, it just feels like, you know, a normal role-playing game. It's not like the game doesn't work without them. So, you know, it's something you can kind of ease yourself into if you need to.
And I think it's one of those mechanics that the more you play, the more comfortable you get with it.
Definitely. Definitely.
Unless you have a session like my last one where my players rolled 9 ones.
Oh my gosh.
I ran out of GM intrusions after a while. And I was like, wow, I just feel bad at this point.
Yeah. I've definitely had sessions where I'd swear no one could roll above an 8 for a long time.
Well, actually, funny story. One of the people I've talked into running Numenera is running it exclusively because the GM doesn't have to roll dice.
Oh, cool.
I've never seen anyone roll more ones in every system that we've played than this guy. He would roll them back in second edition. He rolled them in third edition. He would make critical botches in Shadowrun. He would botch in World of Darkness. It was amazing. I actually convinced the GM in a second edition game to let me make a spell where if you rolled a one, you could re-roll the die just for him because it happened so much.
Wow.
So finally, when I was telling him about this system, he's like, wait, I don't have to roll dice? Oh, I want to GM that one.
Yeah, that's got to be rough when the GM is rolling ones all the time.
Oh, yeah.
I actually always had the opposite thing, especially in my D&D games. If I played, I was the one that tended to always roll really crappy. But whenever I GM'd, I would just roll 20s left and right. And it was to the point where a lot of times I had to fudge rolls because otherwise I'd just be killing players all the time just because I'd just roll 20s all the time. It was crazy.
I have definitely been there more than a few times. You start getting really dirty looks from the table where people are like, oh, really? Again? Yeah. Another critical?
Right. And then it's like they don't believe you and you have to lift your screen and show, no, look, there's a die. I really rolled a 20 again. So I'm curious, as a GM for Numenera, do you miss ever rolling dice or are you happy not to roll dice?
I'm actually pretty happy not to have to worry about it. The dice really add kind of a randomness to the game, a real kind of hit or miss on the GM side.
Sure.
And like you were just talking about, there's always that worry of, oh, are the players going to think I'm messing with this? Do I actually need to be messing with this? Because otherwise they're going to get wiped out because I'm just not a good streak. I feel like even if it's still random, the players feel like there's a lot more agency always knowing the roles are on their side. So it lets me just really focus on the storytelling aspect.
Yeah. And then when you do actually screw with them, it's all above board because it's a GM intrusion.
Exactly.
You're not trying to be sneaky.
Well, occasionally.
Yeah, occasionally.
You just have to get really inventive with how you're being sneaky.
This reminds me, I just played this weekend. And I had kind of a special case because I normally have 4 players, but for various reasons that night I only had 2. And there was this one particular part where there were a lot of traps involved. And the adventure itself had some suggested GM intrusions that were really, really cool. And I was, you know, planning to use them just because I almost always use all the GM intrusions like suggested in an adventure just because they're usually pretty decent and, you know, it's one less I have to think about. Mm-hmm. But there were only two players. And so this player is trying to jump over this pit. And they were basically, they're in this room where there were very few places in the room you could go that there wasn't a trap of some kind. And there were places where you could actually get hit by multiple traps at once. And they were doing pretty good because the Nano had like scanned everything extensively. So he basically knew where all the traps were and knew where all the triggers were. But just trying to navigate through this room, even knowing where everything was really challenging. And so he's making this roll to jump over this pit trap. And knowing that he was going to land in a space that was going to trigger another trap, but figuring it wouldn't be as bad as the pit trap. So he makes the roll, and he actually failed the roll, and he was about to spend an XP to re-roll. And I said, well, I tell you what, before you spend that XP, I'm going to do a GM intrusion that you actually, you don't make the jump as far as you wanted to, and you land on the pit trap. And he's like, okay, I'll take that, you know? So I give him the XP. So there's only two of them. So he gets one and the other guy gets the other one. And then he says, so now I get a speed defense roll to avoid like actually falling in the pit, right? And I said, well, normally you would, but I really wanted him to fall in this pit because there were some developments that you found at the bottom of the pit that if no one fell in, they'd totally miss. So I said, but I'm throwing another GM intrusion at you that you don't get the roll and you just fall in. And so then, you know, he really had to think about that one. And so finally he's like, okay, I accept it. So then they each get another XP and then he falls in the pit. And then there was a GM intrusion that was in the adventure. And there were these like iron spikes, of course, at the bottom of the pit that you land on. And so I said, okay, here's another GM intrusion. The iron spikes are poisoned. And so he really had to think about that one, but he ended up accepting it. So I literally in the span of one round, I gave this guy three GM intrusions.
And that was a lot of XP too. So
yeah, it was. And I mean, his character ended up, he was debilitated. So he was two steps down the damage track. He lost a bunch of pool points. He actually didn't have the skills to get out of the pit, and they'd used all their rope like prior to this. So they didn't have any rope. He couldn't climb out of the pit without rolling really well, and he wasn't feeling lucky. And so then another great thing about the game was he ended up using 4XP and doing one of his advancements, and he took a new nano ability that basically let him jump out of the pit. And he described really well how he was down there, like worrying about how he was going to get out and kind of meditating, and how the nano like revealed this new thing he could do to him. And it was really cool because, you know, in most games, I would have had to come up with some, you know, really contrived way to get him out of that pit, or the other guy would have had to go all the way back to town to get more rope to get him out. And it just would have been a pain. But he was able to just, you know, advance his character, spend some XP. And he had three, I think he had three options of different ways. You know, one was buying a temporary ability to get out of the pit. One was actually getting the permanent esoteric as an advancement. And then the other one, I told him, well, you know, you have quite a few ciphers on you. You could spend the 3XP to create an artifact, you know, and like sacrifice your ciphers for parts, and you could make an artifact to get you out of the pit. So it was pretty cool. He had three ways that he could get out, even though he really didn't have a way out, without me having to like do a
GM intrusion to get him out.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. You know, we were talking about how if this would have been any other game, and if I would have tried to do what I did to his character, like he could have gotten pissed and just walked away from the game and never come back. Mm-hmm. But because it was a GM intrusion, and because, you know, they each got 3XP out of it, and each step of the way he had a choice.
Yeah.
It was actually a lot of fun, and everybody was cracking up, and, you know, there wasn't any bitterness or, oh, you're trying to screw me over kind of thing.
Yeah, that was something a lot of players have expressed a worry about when we first started talking about the game, was I'd bring up the idea of GM intrusions. They'd be like, oh, that's just going to let you mess with me.
Right.
And then once they actually see them in play and know that they get a choice of, well, you don't have to have this happen.
Right.
And they were like, oh, okay, this is way better.
Yep.
So I've gotten a lot of really positive feedback from everybody who's played about that mechanic.
I think so far I've only had once or twice had a player refuse a GM intrusion. They almost always take them, which is
cool. I've gotten
cool.
a couple that people have taken a pass on.
Now, do you usually tell them what it is ahead of time, or does it depend on the situation?
I'll usually give a pretty good idea of what's going on.
Okay.
So, for instance, like a cipher going crazy and striking the wrong person, a foot slipping and accidentally falling back into the pit when you thought you were going to make the jump, stuff like that.
Okay.
But if it's on a one, I'll just come up with whatever's off the top of my head.
Sure. Awesome. Yeah, I've wondered about that myself, because it's like, well, they get a chance to refuse, so I feel like it should be at least somewhat of an informed decision. But then sometimes, based on the nature of the intrusion, you don't necessarily want them to know exactly what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was just curious how other people handle that.
I think what actually would be really great to have eventually would be a website with a big database of GM intrusions that people could submit stuff to.
Yeah. I've had the same idea. I'd actually like to do it if I could figure out how to do that. Like actually have a searchable database and have them categorized. Like, you know, I need a GM intrusion involving a roll of a one with a longbow, or, you know.
Yeah. Like, I need a social intrusion
that
has nothing to do with combat.
Yeah.
Oh, here's all these different options I can look at.
Or I need a great intrusion for in a thunderstorm.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's plenty of room for that idea to grow out there. Probably a lot of people have had it.
Yeah, it's just making it happen. That could be really complicated, I imagine. I don't really know anything about that. I'd have to have probably my wife do that for me. She's the web designer / developer.
Oh, see, you've already got somebody who could help.
So, have you played and run Numenera, or have you just run it so far?
I've gotten to play in it, and I've gotten to run it.
Awesome. So, how do you enjoy playing the game?
It's good. I really enjoy it. I like that, as a player, I feel like I have a lot of agency. I feel like the choices I'm making matter. And I honestly really love the connection system. The sort of write-off... Oh, I know you, and I know you, and I know you. I've got some kind of connection to everybody off the bat.
Yes.
And so it's really never just, oh, here are four other strangers. Yeah. We are going to do a thing for no apparent reason together.
Right. And you all trust each other and get along.
Ah, I see your party has no mage. You seem trustworthy.
Yep. So, I guess I'll switch gears a little bit here. You know, we were talking by email a little bit before, you know, I guess as we were setting up this interview, and, you know, you've mentioned that so far in the AMP segment, I've mainly focused on using the creatures as antagonists. And, I think you have some ideas maybe of how you can use these creatures as protagonists as well.
Well, it's actually just something I'd really love to see explored a bit more.
Sure.
We've really got a kind of firmly grounded set of antagonists there. But with protagonist in the name, I thought it'd be interesting to kind of play around with that a little bit. Maybe see some interesting ways that the PCs could wind up working with, or throw out ideas where the PCs will wind up working, maybe even for some of the creatures from the bestiary in the core book.
Yeah.
Like... I don't have exact specifics off the top of my head, but something like maybe having to repair a Dread Destroyer instead of just having to go face one in combat, or having a Filethis suddenly save the party for its weird, inexplicable reasons. Would just be a kind of neat twist to interject there.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree, and I'm going to accept your challenge.
My GM intrusion, if it were?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, maybe that'd be a cool thing to do with the segment from now on, is each thing, see if I can come up with a way to use it as a protagonist, even the ones that aren't, you know, don't have really an obvious, well, this is how you could do it.
I mean, I think those are some of the most interesting ones.
Right.
Are really the ones where it's very firmly like, this is a monster that you go out into a ruin and fight.
Right, Right.
Well, what are some ways we could play around with that idea? Which I think is very core to Numenera, is kind of taking those classic ideas, taking those particularly fantasy tropes, and really kind of turning them a ways and seeing what comes out.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Dread Destroyer would be great for that. Because that would still be super challenging, because it's a level 10 creature. So,
oh yeah,
even trying to repair it, it's still going to involve really difficult rolls and having to use a lot of resources, and
maybe having to do stuff like go out on adventures and have encounters to get the right tools or to get the right parts.
Right. So, right. Yeah. Totally.
Maybe it's threatening to launch missile salvos into Key if you don't fix it.
Right, or it's maybe it's gone crazy and it's just rampaging around, destroying everything in sight, and
it'll be easier to fix than fight.
Right, right. You get an asset to fix it because it wants to be fixed. So it's a little easier than trying to fight it.
And you'll need all the assets you can get.
And you won't die if you fail.
Well, maybe.
Well, yeah, you might die. Yeah, that's really cool. So I'm curious, are you interested in The Strange as well? Are you planning to check that out and play and or run The Strange too?
I've followed The Strange much less closely than I followed Numenera. Okay. The Numenera setting really kind of grabbed me.
Right.
And yeah. It was just so different than a lot of the other game systems I've run. The Strange felt like a weird kind of mix of Planescape and the X-Files to me.
Yeah, totally.
Which is very cool, but that's kind of an idea I've wrapped my head around before.
Mm-hmm.
Something like Rift, something like GURPS or World of Darkness. I felt like I'd played around with some of those ideas before.
Yeah.
But Numenera as a future fantasy with medieval level technology, but also super advanced technology. And that fusion of two really disparate settings felt very new to me. So that's really kind of caught me.
Yeah, I totally agree. I haven't talked about The Strange as much on the show as I'd like, because I've been in the playtest. So I'm really leery of crossing
spill any of the beans.
Yeah. and so I decided it's better just to err on the side of caution and just not say much at all, as opposed to accidentally say something I wasn't supposed to. But yeah, I definitely have a lot of things to say about it once I can say things about it. But I'm like you. I'm the at least so far the setting of Numenera hooked me a lot more than The Strange has.
Mm.
But one thing about The Strange that I am very excited about is it's very similar to Changeling was, the old Changeling, in that with the recursions you can use it to pull in anything you want, you know, any genre, any setting. And I really love that about Changeling. I did a lot of stuff in the Dreaming, and I loved being able to mix and mash, you know, everything from Lord of the Rings to Star Wars to stuff I totally made up myself and Greek mythology, and just throw it all together. And so at the very least, I'm sure I will be doing a lot of mining in The Strange for cool things to do in Numenera, because I mean, it seems reasonable that you could in the Ninth World find some kind of portal or something that could take you to The Strange or take you to some of these crazy recursions. And so you could kind of bring that stuff in.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, the newest Glimmer has something that would work kind of well for that as well. Have you read Beyond All Worlds yet?
Yes, I have. I'm a huge fan.
Oh, it's so wonderful and awful at the same time. Just, ooh, I would not want to send my players there. But at the same time, I really want to send my players there.
Yeah. I'm running one campaign now. Well, the Devil's Spine. And then I'm going to be starting another campaign. And I was really wanting, when I first got that, I was thinking, maybe I can work this into one of the campaigns. But after I read it, it seems so likely that it could easily turn into a campaign by itself, depending on what the players choose to do with it, that I was like, I really don't want to stick this in another campaign, because I'll never get to the rest of the original campaign, because they'll just get caught up in all this stuff and we'll just be doing that forever. So I think you almost want to, you know, have that, you know, maybe do a one shot or something before it, but you know, have your campaign pretty open if you're going to run that, because it could keep you guys entertained for a long, long time.
Oh, definitely. And I think that could be a really good kind of jumping point if you want to mix and match things from The Strange and from Numenera. That adventure could really serve as a good bridge for that.
Yeah, you're totally right. I didn't even think of that. But yeah, it totally could. That'd be a great way to do it. Food for thought. So I know that like me, you've been running pre-published adventures for Numenera because you're often short on time. But you told me that you created an adventure to get the PCs from the Nightmare Switch to the Hidden Price, and that you had a lot of fun with that.
I really did. I oftentimes am running short on time. I don't have a lot of prep time. So I tend to really kind of lean on the pre-published adventures that they have. Mm-hmm. And I love all four of the ones that are in the core book, and I like the Nightmare Switch.
Yeah.
So after doing that one, I wanted to go through the next one and really kind of play around with those. So I was dropping hints about some of the other ones, but I wanted to move the players into the Hidden Price, because that's one I very rarely hear anybody talking about.
Yeah.
So I decided to switch the location from the Steadfast to the Beyond.
Okay.
So that it would work well for moving from the Nightmare Switch.
Right.
And I said, well, okay, I need to get them to a big city. So I started looking through the setting material. I found the biggest large city nearby. And I said, okay, what would get them from point A to point B? And I just kind of came up with this little journey that they would have to take, these different plot elements they would encounter along the way. And I figure it'll be like half a session, tops. But each new thing they encounter, they just need to explore. And they're right. Like, oh my God, this is so cool.
Right.
What is going on here?
Yep. Yep.
So it wound up taking 2 full sessions to get started on the Hidden Price.
Nice.
Just because of how long they wanted to spend digging into the material just in between the 2 points.
Very cool. So they did the Nightmare Switch first and then the Hidden Price, or?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Cool. We started with the Nightmare Switch. We got through that. And I then moved the PCs from, I want to say, right around Nibelich to Laharic.
Okay.
Which is sort of the largest city out in the Beyond. But while being still very metropolitan, it's really devoted to the practice of bloodletting and this blood cult.
Oh, okay.
And there are all these flagellants who walk through the street like whipping themselves or attacking people and just picking sacrifices at random. So it's not what you would traditionally think of as a large cosmopolitan city.
Very cool. That's awesome.
And so the players were really unhappy being in that city and were like, oh, we hate all of these people. They're all terrible. And they wound up getting in a fight with some guards, and they were shocked that it was not level appropriate.
Oh, so, okay.
And that's one of the things that I really like about the game is it's very easy to just come up with stuff like that on the fly.
Yeah, totally.
So, like, I had expected the NPC guide who is leading them to basically be picked out as a sacrificial victim, and he would tell them to run, and he would try and escape, and they would escape, and they'd have to try and meet up later. And they were like, heck no. No, we're fighting them. I was like, okay, if that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
And so even though I didn't really have that planned, the couple of notes in the Laharic section were all I needed to roll up a couple of these priests, a couple of these giant cat-like creatures that they have as mounts, and a handful of guards.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm like you. I haven't really heard anybody say anything about the Hidden Price either. And when I was working on starting my own campaign of my own creation, I came up with the idea of starting with just a little one shot because I have my wife is going to be playing, and she played Numenera once, but it was just a one shot with me, and she was the only player. So, you know, she's not 100% sure if it's going to be her thing or not. And, so I came up with this idea of, well, I'll start the campaign with a one shot So at the end of that, she or anyone else can say, oh, you know, I've had enough of this, I'm done. Or mm-hmm. they could say, this was cool, but I want to try a different character. And then yeah. and then kind of start the campaign at that point. So I thought, well, I'll just use one of the published adventures because, you know, they're all really good. And I decided to use the Hidden Price because I don't really hear people talk about it either. And I think it's a great adventure to start out with. It's the very beginning of it isn't the greatest because I like, especially with a new group, I like to start an adventure with something happening to get things going. I found if you just start people off and there's not something going on, even if they have something to do, it kind of takes a while to get momentum going. And that one, like they have something to do, but it's a little bit of waiting and hemming and hawing at the beginning of the adventure. But I just really like the adventure, and it's kind of, I'm hoping we can do it in one session, and it kind of shows the exploration aspect of Numenera. It's not like a real combat heavy adventure. So I think it's a great adventure to kind of set the tone but I, like you, I moved it. I actually put it in Charmond over by the Black Riage because I wanted to do some things over in that part of the world. So yeah, it's kind of cool that we both kind of grabbed that adventure.
And it's weird. It's one of the ones that I almost never hear people talk about. I've heard and seen on forums a lot of people talking about the Nightmare Switch, yep. a lot of references to the Beale of Barragal.
Yeah.
And some Seed Ship. Some to the Seed Ship and a couple to the Three Sanctums. But almost nobody talks about the Hidden Price.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a shame because I think it's got some really neat stuff in there.
Yeah, I don't know that I've seen anybody talk about the Three Sanctums myself. I'm actually going to use that one in my campaign too. Because it takes place in Charmond, and part of my campaign is it's going to involve the Aeon Priesthood quite a bit. And I like the Three Sanctums because it sets up the Convergence as like kind of antagonists to the players. And I mean, obviously they're antagonists to the Aeon Priesthood. So I wanted to use that because I really like the idea of the Convergence being like kind of like this antagonistic organization throughout the campaign that the players have to deal with over and over again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are set up as just like the best bad guys.
Right. 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 But they're also like, they're not like a two-dimensional bad guy either, because you could present them in such a way that, you know, or an NPC in such a way that the players are kind of like, well, I kind of see where he's coming from. You know, I don't really agree with his methods, but I don't really that much disagree with, you know, why he's doing what he's doing.
Oh, absolutely. And I think those are some of the most interesting NPCs that players wind up encountering, you know, are the ones who really kind of challenge the preconceptions of the setting. So if they're dealing with a corrupt branch of the Aeon Priests, or if even the Aeon Priests as a whole turn out to really be kind of not working for the betterment of the players, they might wind up turning to the Convergence to be the good guys in the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, very
true. So I think that kind of playing with expectation is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had the same experience as you, where I've had a couple places in the campaign where I need to get them from A to B, and I need something kind of like a segue adventure. Mm-hmm. And what I ended up doing was I actually took a creature from the bestiary that when I read the use part for this creature, like I basically, it just gave me, it'll probably end up being anywhere from a 2 to a 3 session adventure just around this particular creature. And I haven't talked about him on the podcast yet because I don't want to spoil it for the players. But once I've gotten them past that part, I'm definitely going to talk about it because it's a really cool creature in the bestiary that, yeah, the use section is just like basically, hey, here's an adventure you could do. Have fun with it.
I find pretty much the use section is always almost at least a short adventure on its own.
Yeah.
I mean, you could really get a lot out of the creatures in the bestiary, even in the core book.
Yeah.
There's just so much meat there in like 2 sentences.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to say that I think the bestiary is also basically an adventure book, and that's awesome. And I think that's also like what we're talking about, taking some published adventures and kind of stringing them together with some things that you come up with in between. I think that's a great way for a new GM to try out game mastering, because you can start out with something where everything's spelled out for you, and then you can come up with your own thing. And, you know, like maybe end up like you, where you have way more fun with the stuff you came up with yourself, and you just end up doing that all the time.
Exactly. I think it's also a system, and the adventures in particular that are presented in the core book are presented in such a way that GMs can really feel free to mess with them.
Yes.
To change where they take place, to change what happens, the order of events, the level of the things. It's all very flexible, which in some systems is not the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I think all, or at least most of the adventures, at least in the core book, say, you know, this adventure could easily take place anywhere you want.
Yep.
and I love that, and that they actually seem to, when they write the adventure, they write it in such a way so that if you do like move it from one city to another, or from the Steadfast to the Beyond, that there's not a whole lot of things that it's gonna mess with. And a lot of time, like I think the Hidden Price, I don't think I had to really change anything, except there's this,
no, I can't imagine,
there's, you know, the platform that they go over or go to, instead of being over an ocean, it's like over a river or something, you know, like that was literally, yep, all I had to change. And otherwise I just can do it exactly the way it is in the book, even though it's in a totally different place.
Exactly.
You might have already answered this, but what are some of the challenges and interesting ideas you run into when you create your own original content for Numenera, or when you modify published content like adventures? Are there any?
I think there are definitely some.
Okay.
I think particularly when you're creating new stuff for this game, it can be really easy to kind of lose the spirit of it. There's a really distinct kind of flavor to all the adventures that they've published.
Yeah.
From the Vortex to Beyond All Worlds to everything that's in the core book, there's this real spirit of exploration, of discovery. And I think it can be not quite tempting, but easy to slip into that old kind of D&D mindset of kick down the door, fight the things.
Yeah. Yes.
And so really trying to build in those different ways of doing things and those different ways of seeing the game.
Yeah.
I think that can be one of the biggest challenges of it, and kind of retaining that spirit and flavor. One of the things that's really worked well for me, though, is I found that as I'm creating interesting ideas, more and more just keep coming up.
Oh, cool.
So once I'll come up with, and particularly by using the setting, I'll say, oh, I need something to deal with this. Oh, this would be really cool if I introduce it here. Okay, then they'll get to here. Oh, maybe then this could happen. And it starts really kind of springboarding ideas into ideas into ideas.
Yeah. I guess one of the ways to keep the right feel of the game when you're coming up with your own stuff is keeping things weird enough. So what are some ways that you use to make sure you're making things weird?
The best suggestion I could possibly give is, as a GM, don't come up with answers.
Okay.
And for me, it's really tempting to say, oh, okay, well, they'll go to this cave, and this cave is a crashed starship, and it's got all this weird technology in it, and it's all ultra-terrestrial, and nope, stop. Going too far. Just, it's a weird cave.
Right.
And then players will start going, oh, why is this here?
Yeah.
Oh, what is this? I bet it's this. And they'll start filling in their own explanations. And the best part of it is they'll be really engaged, and I'm intentionally keeping myself from coming up with the answers that they're looking for, so they'll want to keep digging.
Okay.
In the little short side adventure that I created, they needed to sail from Nibelich to Laharic. And so at one point, as they're in this little boat that's been all salt-proofed because they're sailing over this entirely dangerously salty sea, they're sailing by night, and these huge worm things just rise out of the sea. The players stop the boat because they don't want to get their attention. And they just start making these really like sad, pining noises while like gravitating up towards the moon. and the players are just absolutely fascinated by this. And I've gotten my notes. Do not provide any explanation. Do not even think of one. Just let them mess with it. And so one of the players is like, I want to swim out to them. It's like, okay, you can do that.
Yeah.
And so she's going and exploring this. She's trying to interact with them to find some way to deal with these things. And they're shedding all these giant salt crystals. And it was just so cool. And the players were like, I have no idea why this is happening, but I really want to know. So I think the best way to keep it weird is to keep it weird for the GM themselves, to have something happen and to intentionally not create like detailed backstory for it, to not create a reason. It's just there and let the players kind of explore and discover it.
Yeah, I agree. I'm starting to think more and more that Numenera is a game of subtleties. I mean, I think I've talked a lot about like the subtleties in the system and how, you know, you can kind of read the system and it seems pretty cut and dry and you're like, oh, I got this. And then you start actually running the game and you realize that there's more there than you thought. And I think like what you're talking about here is like a subtlety in the setting, you know, and it's something that I actually missed myself until I had Monty on the show. And I was asking him about if he was ever going to let us know anything about the prior 8 worlds, kind of hoping that he'd be like, oh yeah, we're going to have a supplement come out all about the 8 worlds. And then he said no. And he said that he thought that even for the GM, that should remain a mystery. And it just like the little light bulb went off in my head. And I was like, oh my God, you know, cause I think he said something like, answers destroy mystery or something like that. And it's like the more that you can figure out, there's no mystery anymore. And the weird goes away. I think that's really important. Like what you're saying, like as a GM, when you're creating your adventures, not going too far for yourself, explaining how everything works or why things are the way they are. And it's very different, at least from other games I've run. Like usually in the past, I always wanted to explain things as much as I could so that if the character or if the player started asking questions, I had answers for them, you know, but with this, it's the opposite. It's like you don't want to have answers for them all the time.
Yeah, very much agreed. And I think that by intentionally keeping that sense of mystery, it really kind of encourages the players to dig deeper until they get to an answer. And then that answer will lead to more mysteries.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sort of how far down the rabbit hole do you want to keep going just to go further?
Right. There's no end to the rabbit hole.
Eventually just loops back around.
You end up where you started. That'd be great.
Oh, I got to figure out a way to work that in.
Yeah. Yeah. Be like the Dark Tower.
Oh, that is a source of constant inspiration and frustration for this game because it feels so close to Numenera.
Yeah.
And then at times it feels so different from it.
Right. Yeah, the whole Old West part doesn't work in Numenera. Like you start having people with six shooters, it doesn't really work. I know that you have some interesting thoughts about the science fantasy aspects of the setting. So do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. One of the things that I've really been picking up on, as far as a vibe I've gotten from my players, from other GMs I've talked to, from the community, is there seems to be a really strong divide in the science fantasy element.
Okay.
And even kind of the presentation in the book sometimes goes into the peasants, the lay people, the villagers. They all believe in these very fantastical explanations for things.
Right, right.
This is a demon.
Right.
That Nano is wielding magic.
Right. She's a witch.
That is a golem over there. Whereas player characters, and to an extent the Aeon Priests and the Convergence, really focus on a scientific explanation.
Right.
This is not a demon. It is an ultra-terrestrial creature derived from an alternate dimension of our reality that we cannot possibly comprehend.
Right. Yep.
That is not a ray gun. It is actually a very scientific piece of hardware, which creates an illuminated beam of et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yep. Yep.
And I feel like the setting really benefits from an intermixing of those by not just really kind of putting things into camps of here's the science, and that's right, and here's the fantasy, and that's just what some people believe.
Okay.
I think that part of it really comes from that Arthur C. Clarke quote that kind of inspires the game, mm-hmm. that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Right, right.
And so people really kind of get fixated on that sufficiently advanced technology element of it. So I'm really kind of interested to see some adventures and some campaign stuff that plays around with that a little bit, that maybe creates a setting where the Aeon priests think they have this scientific answer, but it's actually something much more fantastical, that maybe what they believe is the scientific method is going to solve the problem is actually something that's totally going to lead them left field.
Interesting. Yeah, that's cool.
So I'm just really interested to kind of play around with those ideas and see where that leads to.
I think another kind of aspect of that is if someone plays a PC who is more kind of on the mystical side of things and have a PC who actually looks at it from more of a fantastic point of view. Because it seems like in the games I've been in and like the actual plays I listen to and everything, a lot of times it's exactly like what you're describing. The PCs are very, like, they understand what's really going on, or at least they think they do. And you know, they're kind of looking down their noses at the common peasants who think it's magic and all this stuff. So I think it's really fun if you have a PC in the party who thinks it's magic. And especially if that person is a nano and they're actually doing the magic and, you know, they're looking at it from the more fantasy point of view, because I mean, kind of like what you said with the quote, I mean, the tech is so advanced that even the quote unquote scientific understanding that people have is probably as much wrong as, you know, the more mystical understanding, because their knowledge isn't sophisticated enough to really understand what's really going on.
Absolutely. I think I really kind of compare it in a lot of ways to alchemy. They might be getting these processes. They might be getting an end result that looks like what they're going for.
Right, right.
But they could be going completely around the block and have no clue that the process they're doing isn't actually what leads to it, which applies both to the scientific process and also the fantastical side of things.
That's a really good analogy. Yeah, that's awesome.
So I'm definitely interested to kind of play around with that a little bit and see what the player side really kind of does and gets feedback from for that.
And I think if you can present something that just seems like magic to the point that even the players out of character can't think of a scientific explanation for it, that I think that would add to the weird as well. Because
oh, absolutely.
The players are thinking, well, it can't be magic. It has to be science, but yet I can't imagine how it could be science. And that's really bizarre.
And I think that's the kind of thing I'm really looking to incorporate into my games, is that truly hitting that point of you can't tell whether this is magic or science.
Right.
You can't find the science for it, but you're sure that it has to be in there somewhere. And so that leading into kind of where things are going. There's actually the second rule from Arthur C. Clarke, which is the only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture a little way past them into the impossible.
Oh, cool.
So I think that's also very applicable to Numenera.
Yeah. How many laws does he have?
There are three. The first one is, when a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something is possible, he is almost certainly right. When he states something is impossible, he is very probably wrong.
Oh, now see that one I've heard. The one before that you said, I don't think I've ever heard before. Very cool. That's awesome. I think that's probably applicable in the Ninth World too.
Oh, definitely.
That one would probably even work well for the Strange.
I think that's definitely the case.
Yeah.
The Strange seems to all be all about going just a little beyond what actually makes sense.
Right.
Into the realm of sort of this interesting level of really strange sense that you can almost believe.
Yeah. Well, I love that Bruce Cordell has taken a stand on dark energy and explained it for us. That's really great. At least as feasible as anything else we've heard, I think.
Yeah, I'm really waiting for the book to come out before I start digging into all of it. So,
yeah, I have to say, even, I mean, I've done some play tests and I still don't really understand what the strange is or what translation is or how it works or any of that. Mm-hmm. So I am also very much looking forward to reading the Strange Core book, and I'm curious if after I've read it, if I will be any closer to understanding, or if it's just not, maybe it's not meant to be understood. Maybe that's part of the point. I don't know. I was thinking another way to maybe kind of attack this thing you're talking about, of kind of flipping around the science and the mystical, is it'd be interesting if you had a situation where you had maybe two competing NPCs or even PCs, and one of them is approaching the problem from a very kind of scientific Aeon priesthood point of view, and the other one is approaching it from a very, like, throwing animal bones in the cooking pot and saying chants and prayers point of view, and the person doing the more fantasy approach is actually more successful.
Mm. And I think that could definitely be interesting.
Why is that?
Don't come up with an explanation.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But that could be, you know, that would be the question, right? That the players, yep, would be wondering is, well, what's up with that?
And I think that's the kind of mystery that'll really get them hooked on finding an answer.
Yeah.
And so it'll really kind of catch people and really kind of pull them into it.
Yeah, I think I kind of misspoke a little bit on earlier episodes, because I used to talk a lot about what I like to call the red herring phenomenon in the Ninth World, where, you know, any little weird thing you put in the player's path, they could very well spend the rest of the gaming session like investigating that. And when Shauna Germain was on, you know, I mentioned that to her, and she, not to paraphrase her too much, but she basically said that she didn't really, she wasn't a fan of that because she didn't really believe in red herrings. She thought that anything like that the players wanted to dig into, that you should come up with some interesting things for them to find and you know, make it interesting. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about that since then, and I've kind of come around to her way of thinking. And I don't, we need another term other than red herring, because red herring suggests that it doesn't really mean anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, a red herring really kind of implies that it's a distraction.
Right.
And while players are definitely distractible in my experience, I think that part of the idea behind that kind of exploration is the adventure is really where they're looking.
Yeah.
If they want to dig into, oh, these are beetles and all of them have my face on the back? That is the weirdest thing ever.
Right.
That can absolutely be the adventure right there.
Right. Now, this wasn't in my notes I sent you, but I've been thinking about this through our whole conversation. You know, something that's occurred to me recently, because I've been running a lot of almost entirely published adventures for Numenera so far. And, you know, obviously a published adventure, usually they're kind of, at least to some degree, linear. You know, the players start out at point A and they go to point B and point C, and maybe, you know, they can do it in different orders, but they always end up at the end of the story somehow, right? And the adventures, you know, they do a good job of trying to get around that as much as possible. But it's still, I mean, any published adventure you play, unless it's just a complete sandbox, it's going to have like kind of a plot to it. And I think part of what Shauna was getting at with the red herring is that the red herring, that very idea, like part of that is that there is a plot, that this is the story that I'm telling, and this is, you know, how the players succeed at this story. And it really seems like Numenera is more, works better with a complete sandbox, where you just throw them in some weird place with weird things going on and let the PCs decide what they want to investigate and where they want to go. So have you had similar thoughts? You know, do you think ultimately we should be just running Numenera as a total sandbox and not even coming up with quote unquote adventures? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I don't actually think I'd agree with that.
Okay.
I think that the adventures and the storylines are really what catch people and kind of hold them. Just kind of going out in the world and doing stuff is always going to be interesting. But I think where the real meat of the game lies and where the real kind of meat of that idea of it not being a red herring is found in the next adventure. Sort of,
okay.
I'm going from point A to point B, but in the process, I find this really interesting thing I want to investigate. And so that then leads to the next from point A to point B.
Gotcha.
There's still that storyline to follow. There's still some element of plotting to it. Because for the GM, it would get kind of boring just saying, oh, you're going to go to X place now. So we'll just throw some stuff that happens between point A and point B.
Right, right.
So, I mean, I really think for the GM side, at least from my perspective, it's that creation of a plot, that creation of a storyline that really kind of catches people and really pulls them into role-playing in general.
Yeah, that's a really good point about tying into the next adventure. I like the idea of having, like, when adventure one ends, the players having more things that they could do for adventure two than they actually have time to do. And they have to have a discussion about, well, which of these things are we going to go after next? Which of these weird things are we going to try to figure out?
I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that players are really going to kind of do that for themselves.
Yeah.
At the end of each adventure, there could very easily be ideas of where they want to go next, which are always going to be beyond the scope of whatever could be written in a published scenario.
Sure.
Now, that was actually one of the things I always used to like a lot about the old Dungeon magazine that would come out for AD&D.
Oh, yeah.
Was at the end of all of the adventures, they would have, so what's next?
Yeah.
So where are some directions you could take that in? And I think that would be great to see. So to give the GM a couple of ideas of, oh, so you've saved this tiny village. What happens there now? Are the PCs going to stick around? If they don't stick around, what happens to the village? Would maybe they get a request to come back someday and help? And all the kinds of different ways you can play around with what's next.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great way to do it. And if you are writing your own adventures, maybe, you know, leave some room here and there for the PCs to go off on a tangent if they want to and check something out. Don't always have like a ticking clock where they can't, you know, they can't take a sidetrack if they want to.
Absolutely. I think the most important thing I've learned in all the years that I've done role-playing games is the PCs are never going to go where you expect them to.
Yep. I think I'd have to agree with that. And I don't know. To me, it makes Monty Cook seem almost genius, because at the same time, he's created this system where it's very easy to make stuff up on the fly and figure out what that weird thing is on the fly, and created a setting and a game, you know, based on discovery where the PCs are going to want to go off track a lot, or they are going to want to, well, now that this adventure is over, we want to explore these five weird things that came up, you know, in the last week. And it just all fits together so well. It's pretty genius, I think.
I think the XP system is a huge part of that.
Yes.
By
yes.
taking it away from even succeeding at goals and getting it right. to just getting XP for discoveries and artifacts, you really kind of focus players on that. I mean, that's one of the things that I always really got bogged down with in old D&D editions, was you got experience for beating things.
Right, right.
And players would be like, well, I guess we could sneak around it, but I mean, does that really count as beating it? Like, if we just, like, all turned invisible and walked past, does that really work?
Yeah.
I don't know. We better just go fight it.
Yep.
Because they knew they would get experience for that. That's where the reward system was.
Right.
And so by taking that completely out here, we've got, oh, shoot, it's a giant monster. run away.
Right.
We have literally no benefit in fighting this.
Right. Well, and another part of that in D&D was, well, if we just sneak by, then we don't get his treasure.
Exactly. And I think the cipher limit is one of the toughest things for players to start getting used to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in D&D, what do you do with potions?
You hoard them.
You hoard them. You hang on to that until the one day it might be useful.
Right. Yeah.
And so that just makes me think of all of the video role-playing games and computer role-playing games I've done where I end the game and I'm like, oh, I had 99 health potions, 99 magic potions, 99 extra health potions. I sure did never wind up needing those like I told myself I would.
Right. I should have just used them.
Yep. And so that's one of the things that a lot of players, in my experience, have really kind of stumbled on as they began the game was, oh, well, I have all these ciphers and I might need them one day.
Yep. Yep.
And so when I was a player, I was just just burning through all of my ciphers. If I started a session, I was intending on using at least half or more of the ciphers. Just as soon as I got them, find a use for it.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, I'm down a little bit of might. I use this thing that restores my might points. Like, well, what if you need it? Like, I need it right now.
Right.
I can't carry this stuff.
Right. I'm going to find something else in 10 minutes anyway.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I think really takes some getting used to.
Yeah.
Is the idea of, well, you can't stockpile these things.
Yeah, I agree. I've only played in two different Numenera games so far. And the first one, I actually, it was basically a two shot, and I think I used all of my ciphers but one by the end of the adventure, including ones that I found during the adventure. And then the one I'm in now, I don't think I've used any of mine just because I have these really like very specialized ciphers that, you know, I'm waiting for a chance to use them when I haven't found one yet. But in every game that I've been the game master for, every single one, multiple times, you know, it gets to the point where they find all these really cool ciphers and it's like they have way too many and they have to decide, okay, we need to get rid of some of these, you know, which ones do we get rid of? Or, you know, we have to really take a risk carrying all this stuff. And yeah, I agree with you. I think that that's definitely kind of challenging to learn as a player, to just use them up as fast as you can.
When my players finished the Nightmare Switch, everybody had the max number of ciphers they could carry, and they found like three more. They were like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to bury them in the desert so that if we ever come back here, we'll have them ready.
Right.
I said, okay, guys, do you think you're coming back here to a tiny village in the middle of nowhere in the desert?
Right.
They said, well, just in case, we're going to have them.
Yep.
So I think that definitely speaks to that idea of, well, but I might need this someday, particularly for those really specialized ones.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes those really specialized ones are really powerful. And it's really tempting just to hang on to that because it's like, well, if the perfect situation ever comes up, this cipher yep. will be awesome. Yeah, actually, I think my character in the game right now, he's got one of those. It's an occultic one. And I don't remember now what it does, but it's pretty specialized. And I'm really hoping to find a way to use that soon because it's taking up two slots.
Oof. That's no good.
Yeah. And I'm a first tier nano, so I only have three. Well, Brian, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking about all this. This has been a lot of fun. Been very educational.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Lex. I've been loving the podcast, and I'm looking forward to more.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's just great to talk to other GMs. Like I always learn something from the way, you know, different people look at the game and how they run it and how they play it. And you know, everybody's kind of got their own little spin on it too, which is really cool.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to hearing some other people on the show and continuing to hear everything you're bringing to it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, no problem. And if you ever want to come back, let me know.
Well, thank you.
GM Intrusions wrap up.
It's time to wrap up episode 33 of GM Intrusions. Thanks again to Brian for the interview. If you would like to reach me, you can email me at lexstarwalker@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter for updates on the show at Lex Starwalker. Visit the website, starwalkerstudios.com/GM intrusions to check out the show notes and find some helpful links. Call the voicemail. Leave me a message. Ask me a question. Leave a comment. Sing me a song. Whatever. 626-LEX-GMI-1. Also, GM Intrusions now has a Google Plus community page and a Facebook group. You can find links to both of those in the show notes on the website, starwalkerstudios.com. Would you like to support the show? Help me out? Become a patron at patreon.com/GM Intrusions. And finally, I have an intrusion for you this week. This intrusion comes to us courtesy of H Disco. And this is an intrusion you can use when a PC uses a handheld cipher. So you could use this if the PC rolls a 1 or just because you want to do an intrusion. You grasp the cipher tightly and activate the device. The cipher emits a sudden high-pitched squeal. The muscles in your arm clench involuntarily, and for a moment you feel like you're falling as your center of gravity shifts towards the cipher. The cipher activates and functions at 2 levels higher than intended. It falls out of your hand, making hardly a sound as it hits the ground. Pain shoots through your arm, and you realize it has gone completely out of phase. This lasts until you take a 10-hour rest. During this time, if your character has the ability to go out of phase, your arm always remains in the opposite phase as the rest of your body. So thank you very much, H Disco, for that intrusion. That is really cool. He submitted that intrusion for the contest I had a while back. So thank you again, H Disco. That's an awesome intrusion. And thank you all for listening and supporting the show in the many ways that you do so. Once again, I am Lex Starwalker, and this has been a GM Intrusion.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality science fiction and fantasy podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Ish, Cloudwalker, Renfield, and Transboy. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com.
I'm awesome!